All right, hello and welcome here. This is the Joseph Smith Impressions of a Prophet podcast. I'm Clayton Pixton.
And I'm Susan Easton Black.
And we're glad to be with you. I'm here in almost the center place, Susan. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri, which is pretty close, right?
Pretty close to Zion, yep.
Yep. And you're in the other
I'm
Zion,
in Provo.
Maybe.
Yeah. The heart of education.
There you go. And a good education it is. I got part of mine there, and Susan was part of it. And that's why I'm so smart and, enlightened.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to take all the credit, Clayton. Yes.
Well, you can take part of it. But I've been blessed by my knowledge of Susan and the things that I took her class in college. And I've said that before. So, well, Susan, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to talk about the fall of Kirtland. And our big focus is going to be the Kirtland Safety Society, anti-banking company. It's a long name, but I think people will like what we're talking about this hour and at the end be like huge disappointed.
Yeah, very interesting, and but some good lessons, right, to be
lessons to be
drawn
learned
from it. So this is a good old song that President Hinckley used to like to mention. At least I remember him mentioning it. It's called "Who's on the Lord's Side." Thought it would be appropriate for this, right? So here goes. Guys, I messed up pretty bad on the guitar version of "Who's on the Lord's Side." It's all right. This is a podcast. It's not live. We're going to try it again on piano. Here we go. Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Now is the time to show. We ask it fearlessly. Who's on the Lord's side? Who? We wage no common war, cope with no common foe. The enemy's awake. Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Now is the time to show. We ask it fearlessly. Who's on the Lord's side? On the Lord's side, who? All right, guys. I hope I didn't chase the spirit away too bad, but it's a good message at least, right?
Good message.
All right. There we go. Susan, I'm ready for you. Please take over.
All right. So we're going to be talking about then something called the Kirtland Safety Society. If you have one of those Kirtland Safety Society notes that came out from Kirtland today, they're worth literally thousands and thousands of dollars. So you'd feel pretty lucky, but not if you held it in 1837. So we're going to learn why they always call the end of Kirtland the time of great apostasy. We're going to start, recall, in March of 1836. The Kirtland Temple was dedicated. And we know that Joseph Smith then read the dedicatory prayer, where you can find in section 109. And we also know that a week after the temple was dedicated, that Joseph Smith, along with his scribe, Oliver Cowdery, received sacred priesthood keys and saw Christ in the Kirtland Temple. And you'd say it was such a what they call Pentecostal outpouring, you would assume that it would continue and they would just be living in this amazing spiritual existence in Kirtland. Now they had their temple built and they had the keys to begin the temple work. But such was not the case. And we then start out today within November of 1836. I mean, what is that? You look at it and you're about 8 months now as we start after the dedication. And several of the leaders of the church, including Joseph Smith, came to the conclusion, since Kirtland was the gathering place and people were always gathering to Kirtland, wouldn't it be better if they put their money in a bank owned by Latter-day Saints as opposed to putting it in a bank of the, quote, Gentiles, with the idea that as people gather, we know that banks don't keep our money necessarily in the bank, that they go out and they purchase land and other things with the idea that money that came in, they'd be able to go out, the proprietors of the bank, and purchase land, and somehow it would be a win for everybody, a win for the Latter-day Saints that felt like they had a secure place to put their money, and a win for the principals of the bank. So with this in mind, we get then in November of 1836, church leaders met and they concluded, let's do form a bank, and they came up with articles of agreement. In that process, they're going to select two great men. One is a man named Orson Hyde, and Orson Hyde is asked if he will go then to the state capital of Ohio, and while there to submit a bill asking that the Kirtland Safety Society Bank be authorized. In other words, you can't just say today we'll form a bank. You've got to have a license and all the legal parts. So that's going to be Orson Hyde. They then asked Oliver Cowdery. Oliver Cowdery was told that he was to go east and he was to get plates printed for the money. In other words, $1, $2, $3, $10, $5, that kind of money to bring back plates. So Oliver now heads east, and we turn our attention then back to Orson Hyde. Orson Hyde now heads to the legislature, and there were several banks in little towns in Ohio that were putting forth their ideas that they wanted to form banks too. And when it came right down to it, when their congressional senate now voted then at the state legislature level, it came out with yeas, is how they voted, yeas and nays. Yeas were 11 men voted for, yes, you have a right to establish a bank, and 24 voted no. Now, with that, we now get the two men return back to Kirtland. As they return back to Kirtland, we first look at Orson Hyde. Orson Hyde, at one point, he'd been an employee of Newell K. Whitney in that little store there in Kirtland. He was a very smart man, and he comes back, and he has huge disappointing news that their opportunity to form a bank was denied. Part of the denial has to do with the fact that the proprietors didn't have enough money to be able to back a bank. In other words, enough hard metal. In the case of Oliver Cowdery, he returns with what I think are really beautiful plates where the bank could then print its own money. And the question was, what do we do? In the meantime, they've actually built a building that's right next to the temple. So where the Kirtland Temple stands, there were small buildings that were built on that same kind of temple block, much like Salt Lake Temple, Temple Square. And they had built a building that they could use for their press, their newspaper, but also a building where they could then establish their bank. With that in mind, we now turn to the question of what to do. And the conclusion was, I know what let's do. Let's form an anti-banking company. So you'd say, wait a minute, are you going to act the part of the bank and have people put money in expecting to get that money out? Are you going to act the part of a bank where you put the money in and the proprietors then go and they purchase land and do whatever they want with the money, and it's like a win-win for when investors, they make some kind of percentage on their money, obviously pretty low compared to possibly the proprietors. So they decided on January 2nd, 1837, they would form an anti-banking company with the idea they could still use the plates, they just needed to print in anti, to etch in on them, anti and then ink, bank ink company. And they are now in business. As we can see, you'd say, well, who's going to be the treasurer? who's going to be the man that takes care of the money coming in, going out, making decisions? And that man is going to be the prophet Joseph Smith. Who's going to be the secretary that keeps track of who are our stockholders, how much money are they putting in, and who's then going to work closely? Notice then you've got Joseph the prophet with his scribe on the Bible translation, Sidney Rigdon. And recall, Sidney was with Joseph in Hiram, Ohio, when Joseph is tarred and feathered. And Sidney had been his scribe there with him as he works on the translation. But at this point in the Kirtland Safety Society, they have new titles. Joseph is treasurer, Sidney is the secretary. Well, how successful were they in getting stockholders into their company? They actually got 205 Latter-day Saint stockholders. And the names of the stockholders literally read like who's who in Kirtland. You get Newell K. Whitney, who is the bishop by this point. You get Brigham Young, who's been called to the Quorum of the Twelve. You get Heber C. Kimball. And the list goes on and on. You name the man that held an important priesthood position in the church, and you'd look and you'd say, is he a stockholder in the Kirtland Safety Society? Does he expect to make money on that society? And the answer is yes. So with that, the society is formed. They've got stockholders. The press now begins to now issue these bank statements. Notice it's paper money, and the paper money, it is not backed by gold or silver, nothing hard metal. If some of you that are seeing this, if you look carefully, you can see the anti-banking company. So we're not really a bank, we're anti-bank, and they're in business. And at first, it is a pretty dramatic success. However, you'd say conspicuously missing among the stockholders and even officers in the anti-bank will be Martin Harris. Now, Martin Harris refuses to be a part, but if you were to look at who is the most financially well-to-do man in Kirtland that had gathered there of the Latter-day Saints, and Martin is baptized April 6, 1830, who's our most well-to-do man still, as he has left Palmyra, it's Martin Harris. And Joseph will ask him, you're not on the list. We want you to be a stockholder. He says, no. Sidney Rigdon asks him. He says, no. And the reason he refuses, he doesn't want to put money into any kind of bank. And recall, at this time, every bank issued its own currency. There was no Federal Reserve. There was no backup by the nation. And for Martin, his conclusion is, I'm not going to put my money in any bank with, I don't care what your position is in the church. In other words, financially, I know your bank has got to have a lot of money by your proprietors, as well as it needs to be backed by hard metal. So with that, you'd say, well, Martin at the time, it's like he's faithful in the church. He's serving on the Kirtland High Council. He's been on Zion's Camp on this march we'll talk about at some point, heading to Missouri. And he, along with Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer, were responsible for calling the 12. But in Martin's mind, he has determined that when it comes to temporal affairs such as money, he wants nothing to do with these guys. In other words, Brigham Young comes into Kirtland, doesn't own a pair of shoes. In other words, this is not my group. But when it comes to church matters, ecclesiastical, spiritual, I love these guys, but I'm not going to get involved with them when it deals with money.
That's interesting.
So then we look and we say, as the Kirtland Society, then you've got your 205 shareholders, you've got your officers, and Martin in the face of Sidney and Joseph saying, we need your money, invest in here. In other words, We see it's going great. Martin instead takes $5,020 and he purchases property in Kirtland. In other words, in his mind, it's so much better. Instead of investing in paper wealth, I'm going to do it in land. Land is tangible. It will come back to me. Land, whether it rises or not, at least I've got something I can hold on to. I'm not going to get in some stock anti-banking company.
And my little observation here is just that those who have money often seem to know how to manage it better than those who have never had it.
So with that, you'd say the bank's in business by January of 1837, and it goes good at first. I mean, Clayton, I mean, it's going good. But then in May of 1837, in the city of New York, the cost of flour has gone up. And flour, I mean, it was so important. Everybody ate bread back then, and I don't know if everyone does now, but bread was definitely a staple. Bread and milk for dinner was pretty common. And suddenly, the cost of flour in New York City goes astronomical, according to people. And at that point, there begins to be what's called the run on the banks. And a run on the bank, I've never seen it in my lifetime, but it's where you take your little bank book where you say, I put X number of dollars in, you've sent me a statement, you've told me I have X number of dollars in, now I want it all immediately back.
That's basically where people kind of lose confidence, for whatever reason, they lose confidence in the banks and just want all their money before something happens.
Right. And you can imagine, recall we talked about that banks don't necessarily keep all that money in the bank. They have cash, all right. But in the bank you bank in, back where you live or even where I live, if, you know, 100, 200, 300 people walked in and said, hey, I want all my money out and I want it immediately, suddenly the banks need to close their doors, because they are not prepared for what's called the run on the bank, and it's a panic. Well, as a panic goes, you've got 26 states in the United States. The first banks are the banks in New York to close their doors. And we all know that in panics, you want to keep them pretty localized. But in this panic in 1837, it spreads throughout the United States. So every state is involved, every little town, every rural countryside, you know, mom and pop kind of, here's our dollar bill. They're all, it's a banking crisis.
How would you compare it to the 1929, you know, crash?
Oh, good example. The stock market crash, you know, the same kind of thing. If you want to get a nation poor all at once, you know, stock market crashes, no confidence in banks. And people are desperate. They want their money. And in some cases, they're going to want them in gold and silver. They don't want something that can burn up in a fire. Well, with that, the impact, we now look at what's going on our way. So it's May of 1837 when the panic hits. By June of 1837, Joseph Smith now withdraws from the Kirtland Safety Society Anti-Banking Company. And this is just prior to there being a run on the banks. In other words, it doesn't just all happen in one day, one week, because it spreads across the nation.
So Joseph, it had already started when he withdrew, but not hadn't completed?
Right, right. The banking thing started, but he is withdrawing because he goes, you know, he's got a lot on his plate. He's got, you know, additional family members being born. He's got School of the Prophets going on. He's got missionaries. He's got people wanting to know, what does the Lord want me to do? He's got a lot of church matters going on. And Joseph withdraws. But the problem is that he can withdraw. But notice, as you look at the Kirtland Safety Society anti, do you see the anti-banking? You can see it better there. As he withdraws, the problem is his name appears on every one of those dollar bills, no matter what, you know, whether it's a 1, 3, 2, and so does the name of Sidney Rigdon. So he can withdraw, but then you've got the legal issue. His name is everywhere. Well, with that, we turn to Warren Parrish. Wish I had a picture of the man. But Warren Parrish now takes over Joseph's duties as treasurer. And the problem with Warren Parrish, as the banking crisis is going forward, he becomes like your sticky-fingered treasurer. And, you know, he eventually will apostatize, form his own church, and he's the man that will literally take over the Kirtland Temple, screaming Joseph Smith's a fallen prophet. But Joseph claimed that this man took $40,000. Now, $40,000 today is a lot of money, but certainly not what $40,000 was when you're buying an acre of property for, you know, from $1 to $100. And suddenly Warren Parrish now will take it. So as we look next, we find that money is missing. And Joseph now goes into the Kirtland Safety Society building. Recall, it's built right there on Temple Square. So easy. You go to the temple, you attend the School of the Prophets, you attend your quorum meetings, whether it's the quorum of the 70 or the 12, and then, you know, it's like a one-stop shop, and then you just go right next door and, you know, you do your money things. But as Joseph now goes into the Kirtland Safety Society, although he has withdrawn, he's the one that discovers as he looks over the books, man, $40,000 is missing of what I can't account for it on what we have purchased as proprietors of the bank, and I can't account for it from investments coming in or money coming in.
Tell us about how he figured it was Warren Parrish.
Was it revelation? Perhaps. But Warren Parrish had taken over as the treasurer. And so you kind of look, and he believes it's Parrish. And as you look at Parrish the rest of his life, and his so vehement against Joseph, and, you know, I think Joseph had it figured out right. You know, the man seems pretty unscrupulous as the years come and go. But with money missing, and you got the legal system moving into action, Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, I mean, their name is on every banknote. And so they will be picked up. They will be arrested. The sheriff is a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. He's one of the Johnson brothers. Remember Father John Johnson in Hiram, Ohio? I mean, this all gets pretty messy and pretty sticky. But they are arrested for setting up an illegal bank. And you'd say, well, it isn't a bank. It was the anti-banking company, but it acts the part of a bank. In other words, you name it what you might, it's still acting the part of the bank. Now, it's interesting. Both men will escape after they are arrested and placed in a kind of a jail situation in Kirtland. So we don't have any kind of final thing. Well, by the time we reach November of 1837, the Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company, they're right on the temple site, closes its doors. So how you stop a run on the bank is you close your doors and you say, wait a minute, you're supposed to be open for business from 9 to 5. And if they close the doors, they close the doors. And then when they opened up, it's more of an orderly rather than a push shove. Here's me. I want to be paid. And the problem is that when they were finally paid because of the $40,000 missing, the average investor received back 12.5 cents on every dollar they put in the bank. So I don't know. You know, if you put $100 in the bank and you said, it says so on my bank slip, and you give me back $12.50, are you going to be angry? What do you think, Clayton?
Obviously, yeah. Yeah, obviously.
You'd be like, wow, I worked for this. I earned it. I saved it. I can't believe I saved it. I was so proud of myself. And suddenly, I only get back 12 and a half cents on every dollar. Well, the result will be is here's the big cry. The cry in Kirtland, everybody that had gathered to Kirtland that was a Latter-day Saints knew that Joseph was a prophet. I mean, that's why they're gathering. You know, they've come from Palmyra and Colesville and, you know, all different kinds of places as missionaries have gone out. They're gathering. It's a Mecca. It's their kind of personal Zion. And suddenly the cry on the streets by November of 1837 is Joseph Smith, fallen prophet. And why are they saying that? And the answer has everything to do with money.
I mean, yeah, there's nothing else that Joseph Smith said or did. It was the banking thing, and then all of a sudden he was a fallen prophet. I mean, obviously his name is on there, and the leadership of the church was involved in the formation. But
and so he'd say, yeah. Wait a minute, we've talked about First Vision, we've talked about coming forth of the Book of Mormon, publishing book. I mean, you know, all of those things. And suddenly you'd say, well, from the time the church was organized, we only gave you, 7 years, and now you are a fallen prophet. And the interesting thing, people began to rise up and say, choose me. You know, you get this, Wycombe Clark has formed a church called the Pure Church of Christ. Warren Parrish has got his group. You know, yes, I believe in the Book of Mormon. Joseph's fallen prophet. So to show that it's affected by many, I thought I'd feature Parley P. Pratt. Parley P. Pratt writes an autobiography. Of any of our listeners that want to read something of this time period or the whole time period of the church, by far the best autobiography of the time period goes to Parley P. Pratt. And during this time period, you know, he has difficult days. I mean, you know, the man goes to South America on a mission, a son, little baby dies down there. I mean, the list goes on and on of hardships he faces. But the only time he writes, these are my darkest days, it's during the Kirtland Safety Society. And, okay, my favorite story. You ready for a story? Parley had been up in Toronto, and had in the greater Toronto area, and he brought into the church John Taylor. And he had said to John before he left, he said, gave him such curious advice. He said, if any man, even if an angel appeared to you, or even myself, that Joseph Smith's a fallen prophet, it's not true. And so he had told him up there, but then he comes down to Kirtland and he begins listening. And as he listens, dark days, and here comes John Taylor, who can hardly afford it, comes down from the greater Toronto area, and he wants to see Joseph Smith, but he stops in first to see his great old returned missionary. And, you know, all of you that think they won't find you, you know, you've been in Ecuador and, you know, Chile, you know, wherever you've served, believe me, you're one of the most important people in their lives. They still think you look young. They still think you wear Dockers. They still think, you know, you ride bikes and, you know, your picture's on the mantle. Well, okay, so here comes John Taylor, and he decides first he's going to see his great old return missionary, Parley P. Pratt. And Parley answers the door, and John, you know, he sees John. He says, oh, John, you shouldn't have come. Have you not heard up in Canada, Joseph Smith's a fallen prophet? And here's where you get John Taylor. I mean, you got to bring in the right person, Clayton. John Taylor's grabbing his great old returned missionary, shaking him and saying, don't you remember what you last told me, you know, up in Toronto? And Parley had forgotten it. He had totally spaced it. And John said, you told me that if any man, even an angel, even if you yourself were to say Joseph's a fallen prophet, it's not true. And Parley says, you know, don't tell me the apostasy has caught me too. And then you get John Taylor going with Parley over to see Joseph. So when you're talking dark days, dark days is when you lose your testimony over something that, if you were to look in the long run, just doesn't matter, right? But for Parley, he's caught up in it. Well, notice it's not just Parley P. Pratt. Benjamin F. Johnson, who becomes much more prominent as we move into the Nauvoo era, but he wrote, "Men in high places began to complain." And he's not talking, you know, men that live up on the hill, you know, think, you know, have made all this money. He's talking about men in high places in the church began to complain. And who are they complaining about? Well, they're complaining about a prophet of God. Well, you got to be careful, you know, choose your poison, and they're making the wrong choice here. So I like your song, you know, who's on the Lord's side, who? I mean, Benjamin F. Johnson, men in high places, men are church leaders, are complaining. Well, the impact, to show you the impact, if you were to look at the leadership of the church and you were to say, well, how did they come out after the Kirtland Safety Society? Out of the original Quorum of the Twelve, only three stayed faithful.
Those members of the Quorum of the Twelve who stayed faithful the whole time were David Patton, Heber C. Kimball, and Brigham Young.
And you'd start to look at them and you'd say, what happened to them? And I'd say...
Some of them came back, right? But
right, some but came
all,
back.
But all the other, what, six?
Yeah. Well, so, no, you know, nine. You got nine. Yeah. So nine, and you'd say, well, William McClellan, surely not him. And I go, yep, you know, did I ever tell you about the Kirtland Safety Society? So I think, you know, my message is we got to know the prophet's a prophet, and no matter what is going on, he's still the Lord's prophet, right? So, well, who stayed with Joseph? And I really like Brigham Young. I don't just casually like Brigham. And Brigham's comment during this time, I stood close by Joseph. And don't you wish we could always say that? You know, in other words, I am not cut off by every wind of doctrine. You know, in his case, I came to Kirtland with no money. I'm going to leave here with no money. But you know what? I'm going to stand close
Brigham
to
Young
the prophet
was an
of God.
Independent thinker, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a real independent thinker. And yeah, you know what I like about Brigham's a little aside, but that Kirtland Safety Society, you know, as it falls apart, this Warren Parrish eventually leads a gang called the Parrish Gang. And they go into the Kirtland Temple, and they literally take over the temple. But the crazy thing, you'd say Brigham had been called to be a builder on the temple. And he was a painter, carpenter, and glazier, and his conclusion was, you know, it doesn't matter who's claiming ownership. As far as I'm concerned, I'm called to build it, and I don't think it's perfect. So long after the Lord accepted the house as his abode, and priesthood keys were given, you'd say, who's there first in the morning? And I'd say, it's Brigham Young. Well, you know, if you had a free builder building on your house, you're not going to say, get out, are you with me? And finally, Brigham is seen in the going up and down the crawl spaces, and finally puts his tools down on the top story, comes down, and he says to Warren Parrish, as far as I can tell, the temple's as good as I can make it with the tools I have. So in other words, I'm done. And Warren Parrish says, oh, Brigham, don't just tell me, tell the congregation. And so Brigham turns and he faces him. He says, hey, far as I can tell, it's as good as I can do it. Suddenly there's cheers for Brigham. And then as they went quiet, Brigham gave the building a builder's dedicatory prayer. It's not your section 109, but that's great, right? But he's blessing the doorknobs and the windows and, you know, the hinges and, you know, all of that. And then when he finishes, he said, I, like you, know that Joseph was a prophet. And suddenly the room erupts thinking that Brigham is joining them. You know, he's apostatizing too, but Brigham says, but the difference between you and me is that I know that Joseph still is a prophet. Suddenly, guns come out, knives come out. Brigham is chased out of the temple that he just finished. In other words,
for a long ways, right?
For a long ways. And you go, these were his friends. And I would imagine they're still his friends, but they're not standing close by Joseph.
It's a great story.
Well, all right. So at this point, Joseph Smith now receives the word of the Lord. And in that message, the message was, the time has come that your labors are finished in this place for a season. In other words, you're finished in Kirtland. It's time to move on. And with that, where does Joseph go? Well, he goes to the area you've just been in. Clayton, he heads out to Far West, Missouri. And notice Far West is already laid out. They've got blocks, squared. They've got the center block. They've designated where a new temple will be built in Far West. In other words, they're all ready to go. So he's leaving to then join the saints in Missouri. Now, others will follow that same route, but not everyone. If you were to say, you'd look at the church and you'd say, holding it together, when the saints gathered to Kirtland, obviously some will stay behind in Palmyra and Colesville and Fayette, and then they go to Kirtland. But then the question comes, from Kirtland, how many make that 800-mile journey to Missouri to get in to Far West? And the answer is maybe about half. And that's so
pretty
you'd
big.
Say, when is our first big loss of membership in the church? Where you'd say, in activity, did they all lose their membership? You know, of course not. They just didn't keep moving forward.
I've tried to think of anything comparable, like in our day, like if, you know, what would President Nelson have to do to make that many people say, oh, he's a fallen prophet, this isn't the right place anymore. I don't know. Had to be really huge.
Never have we seen the like. And some will call it, it's like a Abrahamic test. You know, a trial of your faith. And we'll see all along the way during Joseph's lifetime, there will be many trials of faith. But for sure, that was the one that even under the extermination order, you know, in Missouri, they're still moving to follow the prophet. But yeah. Kirtland stopped it. Okay, so what's the big lessons we're learning from this?
Well, so in your lectures at BYU, you talked a lot, too, about the people who, sorry, this probably isn't answering your question directly, I was just thinking, but you talked a lot about the other members of the 12 and what happened to them. Were we going to talk about that at all or not so much?
Yes, okay, we will at some point, but it seems like, you start to look at it and you'd say, Thomas B. Marsh, you know, he actually made it through the Kirtland Safety Society, but when it came to milk and cream and thinking that his neighbors cheating him and not feeling like he got a fair shake at a bishop's kind of court and then moving on to the high council and so forth, you begin to see men at this time losing their zeal. It's like they forgot. They forgot the blessings that were theirs.
Yeah. One thing to answer your question is, I mean, if you have the Holy Ghost, right, if you pay attention to the Spirit and what it says, then you wouldn't be swayed by that stuff. That's one way. I mean, right?
Right.
You could also rely probably on the fact that the prophet isn't going to fall. I mean, I guess we know that now. Maybe they didn't
right.
then. But also, I mean, if how the argument that he's fallen, like what, did God tell you that? I mean, ecclesiastically, did he do something wrong? I mean, I know this temporal thing, you know,
right.
tragic, huge thing happened that he was involved in, but how does that mean he's a fallen prophet? Obviously, you lost money, but how does that mean, you know, just a little maybe logic there? I don't know. What would you say, Susan? What are your
well,
big
takeaways? Well, I know that Joseph was told by revelation that he would not be successful in finance, but you do see him pushing the envelope, you know, hoping to, because he's, you know how you're successful in so many parts of your life, you assume it's all going to be successful. It doesn't always work out that way for everyone.
Are you thinking of where the Lord said, I'll command him to do no other work, or
right.
something else?
Right.
Yeah.
So you do see that. I think for me, it's a, you know, it's a message to just make sure you know what your testimony is based on. Maybe a reason to keep a journal along the way, to write down some of your sacred events, share them with family. I guess I like that John Taylor reaching out and, you know, and helping Parley P. Pratt remember who he was.
Yeah,
and
that is a great.
So, you know, we got to bring somebody into the church. I know I brought in helped bring in a man that used to be a bouncer in the bar. And, you know, I don't know how he ever figured out to wear these kind of what looks like wife beater shirts, you know, with garments. You know, it's a pretty unique person. And, you know, I said to him, if you hear that I'm falling apart, you know, and making, you know, working my way out, I go, do you want to make sure you help me? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you so changed my life. He goes, I'll find you. You know, there's no chance. You know, so you got to bring somebody in that loves you enough to help you remember the truth, and that truth always edifies.
And I'm a big believer. I know, I'm sure you are too. And watch and pray always. Just always nourish yourself with the, you know, the scriptures and prayer, and go to church, be in good places, all that stuff. You just gotta be very vigilant.
Vigilant, consistent. Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear you sing again.
Okay, well, I'm gonna try to do verse 3.
The stone cut without hands to fill the earth must grow. Who'll help to roll it on? Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Our ensign to the world is floating proudly now. No coward bears our flag. Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Who's on the Lord's side? Who? Now is the time to show. We ask it fearlessly. Who's on the Lord's side? Who?
Okay, that was great. So next week, I've actually had an occasion to write on all the people that knew the prophet Joseph Smith. And anyway, it sounds
all
pretty
the people
crazy.
Who knew Joseph
all
Smith.
All the people.
Like an article or a book or whatever.
70,000 pages.
I believe it. I believe it.
Anyway, my dad used to say, hey, what do you want to do? Write a book. And I go, oh, Dad, I want to write the library. And so, you know, I'm working on it. But I went through those people to try and figure out what were the blessings that came from staying, and what happened to the people who apostatized and fought against the church, and what happened to the people that, you know, just kind of dropped off the trail, like in Kirtland, you know. And so I'm hoping next time when we're together, we kind of can look and say, here's what to expect. And, you know, backed up by some pretty serious research.
So kind of a continuation of this lesson.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you that,
long,
you know,
long term.
If you were always faithful, that you were healthy, you know, never a sick day, or, you know, you were well-to-do, or family were always perfect, you know, but that's not it. So stay tuned and find out what comes your way as a result of faithfulness. And then, you know, if you choose not to, what can you expect?
Okay, well, all right. Thanks, guys, for joining us. Again, I'm Clayton Pixton, and
I'm Susan Easton Black.
And we're just so tickled to share this with you guys, aren't we, Susan?
Yeah, we are. Thanks.
Really, I'm not. I'm just kind of facilitating, but I'm so tickled to be here too. So I think Susan is awesome. And so you guys have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time. Who's on the Lord's side? Are you on the Lord's side?